letting the police on their restraint. Well, they still are very restrained. It could be true that technically there are more police officers than there are protesters now, but that wouldn't be a bit of a surprise because we had two long blue lines accompanying the protesters all the way from the patrol van shell down here to Cermak, Michigan.
And what also in the studio with us is one of the leaders, but Mark Casella, who's part of the Occupy Chicago movement. And Mark, what is the plan for tomorrow? What do they hope to do tomorrow?
Sure, let me check here. So tomorrow is actually supposed to be the shutdown Boeing event. So there'll be demonstrations surrounding Boeing. Now, is their intent really to shut down Boeing? Well, we'll see. Really, it's about raising awareness again. And some people said, well, why Boeing? Well, they happen to be here. As Beyond the Beltway guest Art Sear explained, you know, Chicago's a home for some military manufacturing. And Boeing happens to be have a headquarters in the city, so they're an easy target because they're local.
And Boeing, for those listening around the country, Boeing is less than about a mile from where we do our broadcast every Sunday night. Bill, one last question to you. Are you sensing with a police officer, is fatigue setting in, anger, frustration, or are they just keeping their cool?
I think they're keeping their cool. One copper told me that he knows his shift tonight is going to go until 1 a.m. Mm. And so they're just going to wait it out, do it right, and with cameras looking down on them from that Papa John's roof, they're going to make sure that they do it in a way that doesn't turn into a PR disaster.
Okay, well, listen, thanks very much, Bill. I know you're using up your cell phone minutes and sharing them with our audience on Beyond the Beltway. I thank you very much. That's Bill Cameron, veteran reporter for WLS Radio in Chicago, 89 WLS, one of the country's best political reporters, and out on the street tonight covering the demonstrators. And thanks for bringing that update. It appears that the eyes in the sky at Papa John's are keeping everybody here. On their P's and Q's tonight.
Absolutely.
But again, confirming, by the way, we should also mention, for those listening around the country, it was in the 90s today. It was a very hot day in Chicago. And again, we're expecting some hailstorms and some downturn in weather literally in the next couple of hours. So that could dampen things as well. Mm-hmm. Back to our discussion. By the way, our phone lines are open. 1-800-723-8289. We are told that the phone lines work. The only way we will know that is if someone within the sound of my voice will pick up the phone and give us a call. 1-800-723-8289.
I was wondering, Mark, Bruce, that and Mark, you had mentioned early in the show that that NATO does all this bombing and kills all these people. There's no doubt we kill lots of people, and we kill some. Unfortunately, we kill some civilians. But would you accept that we go to the greatest lengths in the history of humankind to avoid killing civilians? Would you accept that?
Sure. We've taken many technological steps to limit and with intelligence on the ground trying to mitigate those kinds of
all that
deaths.
Money spent on these laser-guided missiles that will kill only the people we're supposed to kill instead of carpet bombing. And think of what happened in World War II and the firebombing of Dresden and the firebombing of Tokyo, the things that we would never, ever do. And all the spending on military has led us to the ability to kill the enemy without killing the people who are just standing around.
Sure. Well, I would, you know, a line I say all the time is, rather than dropping bombs, let's drop schools and hospitals. And I think you'd see a much different Afghanistan after 10 years if we had dropped
$20 billion
worth of hospitals
and
schools.
Well, I have a somewhat different take on this, which is I think it's kind of ironic to see the protesters calling for the end of the war in Afghanistan, which is exactly what's happening. So the purpose of the NATO summit, one of the key issues in the NATO summit, is not continuing the war. The whole NATO summit on Afghanistan is all about how to get out, and in fact, the division within the countries of NATO, there's a group that wants to stay until 2014, which is like 2 years, and there's another group that wants to leave faster. So the issue is not how to kind of stay. The issue is how to leave, and then specifically how, as we leave, to transition to more provision of social services as we so that we don't walk away and abandon Afghanistan. Afghanistan like we did in the 1980s and sort of planted the seeds for the rise of the Taliban.
Mark?
During some of the press conferences earlier in the week, international representatives had come to speak out against NATO. And the peace you spoke of earlier that we're enjoying in Europe is also due largely in part to a large American military presence. And so a lot of people's fear that was expressed this week was that 2014 will not be an ending point. There will always be some troops stationed there for our strategic military purposes.
Well, in Europe, actually, we had 300,000 American troops stationed in Europe in 1989. Today, we have something like 57,000. So if you just compare what's happened in the last 20 years, it's true, there's still a military presence, an American military presence in Europe, but it's dramatically drawn down. And in fact, I suspect 5 years from now, that number won't be 57,000. It'll be half that.
Of the 28 nations in NATO, how many of them are real true friends of the United States? And how many are casual acquaintances?
Yeah, well,
and how many can we depend on?
Well, there's the better way to think about it is countries don't really have friends, they have interests. And I think that what you see in those 28 countries in NATO is that they have interests which often coincide with the interests of the United States. But I want to say that one of the big purposes of NATO used to be to act together to defend Europe against the Soviet threat. That's gone. Since 1990, the main purpose of NATO has been to create cooperation among the Europeans so that it's easier for the United States to work with Europe. Now, is that perfect? Absolutely not. But it is the case that the key purpose of NATO now is cooperation.
Mike Miller, on the Sunday morning shows, on a couple of the Sunday morning shows today, they said that when you look at the presidential election in the United States this year, that Barack Obama's future may have a lot more to do with Europe and European politicians and European actions than to what is happening domestically. Do you agree with that? And if so, what are the conditions? What are those elements in Europe that are things that in Europe that are happening right now that could really sink this president?
If the role of the foreign sector in terms of the economy is often overplayed, at least within the United States, because net exports is such a small percentage of the American economy, say compared to other countries like China and so forth, where it's very, very important. So if there were a major collapse of Europe, it would affect the GDP of the United States and job growth, but only by probably 0.3 to 0.5% of GDP. Mm. Instead of growing at 2.5%, we'll grow at 2% or 1.5%. Now, that hurts. We don't want that. But I don't think that's enough to either push the American economy into recession, and I don't think it's enough to push Mr. Obama out of office. The big concern is Greece has already defaulted, so Greece is somewhat off the table. The question is what's going to happen in Spain? And there's a lot of belief now that they're going to begin to try to prop up the banks in Spain, the banks which are really, really in trouble. And if it becomes clear to the Europeans that they're going to protect those banks from collapsing, then Europe may not collapse. And it's just going to be a recession, maybe a bad recession, but it's not going to be a collapse. I still think that Mr. Obama's future is tied up right here domestically.
When we come back, I also want to talk about, as it relates to Europe, I want to find out, obviously, in many parts of the world in Europe, there's strong austerity programs, and then there's others that say, let's just keep spending. I want to kind of separate that within the European community and talk more about NATO. And also, just remember that when the United States was attacked on 9/11, it NATO jets from other nations really were patrolling the skies of the United States. We should not forget that. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly. Phone lines open, 1-800-723-8289. From Austin, Texas to Ashtabula, Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us this evening. During the break, Bob Pitt from the University of Chicago, you were making a point that once upon a time, Chicago was going to have the NATO summit and the G8 summit. The G8 was pulled out of Chicago, and they're going to do it at Camp David. But you were making a point as to
I simply asked, had it been the other way around, had we had the NATO summit at Camp David and the G8, which is an economic summit here in Chicago, would the protesters have gone to Washington to protest NATO, or would they be here in Chicago protesting the G8? And I suspect very much they would still come to Chicago.
Sure. And then I just wanted to make a point of clarification, too. I'm not actually speaking for the Occupy movement. I'm a supporter. I write about them. But Occupy Chicago has their own press committee. But related to this issue, this was a conversation. And I write for the Huffington Post. And this was a conversation people had. And people were very excited, salivating, really, to protest the G8. And when they pulled out, it was seen as a victory on the one hand, but Andy Thayer and the Cangate supporters were already sort of part of the Occupy coalition before, so it only became natural to sort of shift over that way. But also, in a way, pulling out the G8 also allowed the messaging for this protest to be a little clearer. Now, some would say, well, that's the messaging seems really murky from what I'm seeing on the signs. But I think there's been a great effort to educate the public about NATO. I was saying during the break that a lot of young people didn't grow up in the shadow of the Soviet Union, like I did. And so they're not familiar with NATO. Mike had mentioned that some people had gone out on the street and asked the protesters, what's the acronym NATO stand for? And they couldn't answer. Right. So an event like this, I think, for good, whether you're educating about the good things NATO does or its military interventions that people disapprove of.
I think, actually, the longest-lasting effect for the public is not going to be raising the visibility of NATO. It's going to be raising the visibility of Chicago beyond Chicago. What's been happening in the last 2 days, precisely because this NATO summit is the most important military conference, and we have had protesters here, Chicago has now been identified with international issues in a major way. And this isn't in the Chicagoland area. We may not quite see the full significance of this, but this is not just reverberating even in the United States. This is reverberating around the world.
There were solidarity protests today in Tehran, in Scotland, in Ireland, in Pakistan, throughout the world.
What are the other alliances that we have above and beyond NATO?
We have alliances in Southeast Asia, CETO. So we have very important bilateral alliances, say, with Israel. We have important relations in the Persian Gulf, which are kind of bilateral and multilateral at the same time, with Saudi Arabia, Bahrain. If you look at Northeast Asia, you can look at North Korea, and you can start to see that there's not quite a formal alliance around North Korea, but there are six-party talks. So we have other multilateral and bilateral relations, but NATO is by far the most
important. Is there any discussion of internal things that are going on? Because people know that in many parts of Europe, there are issues of immigration. Some of the anti-immigration feeling that we have in the United States, or anti-illegal immigration feeling that we have in sectors of our political environment, they pale in comparison with some of the anti-immigrant feeling in parts of Europe. Are things like that discussed at conferences like this, or is that viewed as too domestic?
I was just at an event yesterday afternoon with Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte. The Netherlands is one of the places that we often don't associate with immigration issues, except 5 years ago, that's exactly what brought him to national prominence. There was a fairly large debate inside the Netherlands about what to do with especially illegal immigrants, much like we might be familiar with in this country. And there were questions. How do we deal with them? Do we just kick them all out? Do we have amnesty and so forth? And this is happening not just in the Netherlands, but a year ago I was in Greece. I was in Thessaloniki. The government, the foreign ministers of Greece, were presenting lots of data about just in the last few years how many immigrants have come into Greece. Well, Greece only has 7 million plus people. They have these huge economic problems. Having even 300,000 immigrants kind of rush into Greece, this is only making those problems even worse. So immigration, those issues aren't really quite divorced from security or economics. They're one of the key things that is actually pushing that rubber band even more taut.
And one other thing you're seeing is that there's been a lot of discussion about multiculturalism in Europe, how they were so much more multicultural than we are, but that's because they had no one else but themselves there. Now that all of a sudden these immigrants are coming in large numbers, all of a sudden maybe multiculturalism is not such a good idea, because they're seeing that many of the groups of people that come in will not become Germans, or they will not become French. They will stay in their own little group, and they will not try to become part of society. And this is beginning to tear the societies apart. They're having problems. It's Americans seem to think that we have some kind of unique anti-immigrant view because of the way we have this battle over illegal immigrants. One of my fields was population economics, and would read about immigrants all over the world and how countries have to try to close their borders and decide who gets to come in and when do they get to come in, and if they come in, what rules must they live by, and so forth. These are really tough questions all over the world, and Europe is really facing them now much more than we are.
Sure, and I agree with what you guys have both said. Members of the Occupy movement might say, or part of their messaging is that what's motivating these massive influx of immigration? Well, there's lack of economic opportunity. Mm-hmm. And anti-immigrant sentiment always increases when there's more desperate financial situations.
Yeah, on that note, we have to say farewell to Mark Casello, who is with the Huffington Post, and again, a supporter of those who are in the streets of Chicago this evening protesting. Robert Pate from the University of Chicago has also joined us, and Mike Miller of DePaul University as well, professor of economics. This program, we're out of time for hour number one of our broadcast this evening. If you're listening to us on radio, we're going to continue with another full hour, continuing to take your telephone calls at 1-800-723-8029 if you're watching us on television. Again, thanks very much for being with us, and we'll see you next Sunday night.
Good work.
Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Professor Robert Pate from the University of Chicago, Professor Mike Miller from DePaul University, and Occupy Chicago supporter and Huffington Post contributor Mark Casello from Calumet College of St. Joseph. And our phone lines open at 1-800-723-8029. That's 1-800-723-8029. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And as we begin hour number two, hopefully everything technologically is working. So wherever you're listening around the country, the phone lines are working. The ISDN line is working. Everything is working. We've got four guests around the table. We're all working as well. And also in the streets of Chicago, the Chicago Police Department is working very hard. A standoff between Chicago police and anti-war demonstrators here in Chicago near the NATO summit, that's at McCormick Place, appears to be winding down at this hour. That's hours after a nearby rally was scheduled to end. There were hundreds of protesters when the confrontation began, but the crowd has thinned considerably as police have held their ground and slowly pushed demonstrators on. Earlier during the scuffle, both police and demonstrated leaders repeatedly urged calm, but tensions flared earlier after a group of protesters pushed repeatedly against police dressed in full riot gear. President Barack Obama is in town, his hometown. He left the NATO summit at McCormick Place after about 5:30 this evening, heading north towards his hotel, his motorcade never passing within sight of the action outside of the convention center. He was then back at the hotel waiting a formal dinner tonight at Soldier Field. And again, he is staying, I believe, at the Sheraton Hotel. And that is exactly, if you were to draw a line between where I am seated right now and you were to go about four blocks, that would be the hotel where the president is this evening. While police and protesters were clashing barricades, created a no-man's land on the streets leading to nearby McCormick Place, which kept the action a safe distance from the NATO delegates. They are at a variety of hotels, including the Sheraton as well. The skirmish started a short time after the official rally had ended. Police tried to force the crowd of several thousand west away from the convention center. Some protesters left peaceably, but others determined to stay, and they create a little problem, and some of them may have been arrested, and some of them may be the guests of the City of Chicago Department of Corrections tonight. Sure. Mark Casello is here. He is with the Huffington Post. He's a contributor. He's a college professor, and he supports what the demonstrators are here for. For those that tuned in late and don't know a little bit about it, but your overall review thus far of the deportment of the protesters.
Sure. Well, what the national audience might not know is that for the past 10 days, there have basically been actions happening every day with different community groups as well as supporters of the Occupy movement and people who have been coming in throughout the nation. I want to underscore the fact that today there was a very successful and peaceful march all the way from the Petrillo band shell down to the down the designated march route. That was largely peaceful. When I was in the march earlier today, I saw just before this clash broke out, there was a knucklehead guy who got into the face of some police officers, was antagonizing, pushing, and the officers have demonstrated restraint. Last night, there was an incident on South Wacker at the intersection of Jackson where some protesters were marching across the bridge. A police van was trying to come through. Some protesters stood in front of the van, which was chirping its sirens, trying to get them to clear out. And a protester from Occupy Wall Street, Jack Amico, lost his balance after being pushed by the van, fell down, and was injured last night. Now, on that case, you had both parties showing sort of signs of stress. The officer wanted to get through, the protesters not taking heed of where those police needed to be at that time, but also the officer driving through a crowd of people and actually injuring one. Now, luckily, Jack Amico was released from Northwestern Hospital overnight.
But you would acknowledge that in the group, you certainly did this in the first hour. You've referred to them as knuckleheads.
Right.
I referred to them as hooligans. There are in any particular protest groups of people, whether it's winning an NBA championship, whatever the case may be, they will take advantage of a circumstance. And they are looking for trouble. And if they can get a video of anything that is slightly perceived to be violent, they will turn that into a cause celeb.
Sure.
And that's Street Demonstrations 101.
Mm-hmm. And what you're seeing also, for instance, this incident last night, So people who, you know, this Occupy movement has been, you know, I've said in some of my columns, the most documented social movement perhaps in human history. There's everybody has a webcam, everybody's streaming, you know, and but the cost of that isn't more transparency sometimes, oddly. What you have last night was fragmented, noisy video. You couldn't quite get a clear story. Then you have conservative blogs picking up this video saying, look, no one was hurt. Here's another angle, and this is somebody else. And so I think my biggest shock, or, you know, maybe it explains my naivete or reveals something, but is that there is so much disinformation happening through just the profundity, the amount, the prodigious amount of media coverage, prolific amount of media coverage, excuse me. And the fact that people can't sift through this. On the radio stations, you hear talk about are the protesters going to be violent? But you don't hear as much talk about the issues. And I think even when good conversations take place like this, the Pritzker Military Library put on an excellent debate between members of CanGate and some local professors. In fact, Jay Williams, who is a friend of yours, Bruce. And so there are really positive things happening. But I think overall, hopefully what comes out of this is that the community is more aware and feels less intimidated to get out into the streets for things they believe in, whether it's what Occupy stands for or what they stand for in their own communities.
And in this particular case, we should mention what I have been talking about for the last several months on this program is whether or not the events of this weekend, and we don't know, there's day and a half to go, maybe 2 days to go, before things sort of peter out and go their separate ways. There hasn't been anything that has happened thus far that would indicate that voters, American domestic voters, would retaliate against an incumbent Democratic president as they once did in 1968 against the administration. Many of the protesters here obviously are specifically mentioning Barack Obama by name, again, in this this charge yesterday that was going to be in a, you know, an attempt to bomb his campaign office.
And I think that what you're seeing with the security preparations is that we've learned from 1968.
Yes.
I think that it's virtually impossible to get into downtown Chicago with a Molotov cocktail. I think that that's all to the good. Yesterday afternoon, I took the Metra, that is a train, from the south side of Chicago into downtown Chicago. And the fact is, you can't get on that train if you have a backpack. I don't mean they're going to search your backpack. I mean, you can't get on the train with a backpack. If you have a purse, they're going to search your purse for women. But what that means is that there's just, it's almost impossible, not quite impossible, but almost impossible to have any large-scale lethal violence from the protesters, which means that we're likely to have restraint on the part of the police.
That's good news. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion of NATO and also talk about the domestic politics and how that might be affected by foreign affairs, and also ask our guests, on the world stage, is America better today than it was 4 years ago? Back to you. From Youngstown, Ohio to Carthage, Tennessee, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. Let's go to Brian, listening to us in Roselle, Illinois, on our flagship station, 89 WLS. Go ahead.
Hi, good evening.
Hello.
You know, I watched a lot of the protest action on local TV, like around 5 o'clock Central Time, and that's when it kind of came to a head. You know, and to me, it's just galling to me at the hundreds of millions of dollars wasted taxpayers' money. I mean, you had about 50 to 100 troublemakers surrounded by, you know, hundreds and hundreds of law enforcement people at the cost of millions and millions of dollars. I mean, it's just crazy what our government does. You know, the government could have had this conference anywhere. They could have done it at a remote Air Force base in North Dakota. They could have done it on an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean. They could have done this anywhere. It just shows you it's just a government junket. All of this was federal dollars flooded into the city of Chicago. You know, it mostly adversely affected business people, the small businessman in this area. It was just a big joke. I think Rahm Emanuel should be embarrassed.
Mike,
lot of your local citizens are very angry.
Mike, what about that? Because I would agree that I know just, and I live just a block from this, where we do this program, and I know that the restaurant, you know, right in my building is closed.
Yes.
The cleaner is closed. There's several places that are closed.
That's right. My office at DePaul.
Museums, all museums, yeah. Major museums were closed today and tomorrow for fear of this.
Yeah.
So
my office is right in the middle of the loop, and we have a large building, and our tenants include a major bookstore and restaurants, and these are people who need to make a living, and they're all closed. We aren't even allowed to get into our building Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Monday because they're afraid that something could happen, and if somebody at the university gets hurt, gets into the press, this would be bad press for the university. So the economic consequence is quite negative. Now, there is one thing, though. I mean, we do have the right to peacefully assemble, and I want to stand behind that 100%. It's right there in the first...
Wherever we want.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
No, I think the caller makes a great point, and I just want to say this. What hopefully the average Chicagoan sees, and hopefully enough people come downtown to see, is that Chicago has a lot, very many police, and these are very talented and professional individuals. And the question I find myself asking is, why is there a night of violence in the city of Chicago when there's 400, 500 officers that could be walking the beat in the neighborhoods on the west sides and the south sides? Governing's about priorities and choices, and it seems to be that this was a choice to prepare
for
this.
I come back. You know, when you know, for the last several months, the buildup, everybody's going to come to Chicago. The history of this of this movement and the G8, the combination of both. Certainly it started with the G8. The history of that over the last several years is violence. It's happened in a lot of cities.
But you have to
you can't, on one hand, you can't say, well, you know, it's not going to happen here. and not prepare for it,
yeah,
because
sure.
you would be damned if you did that.
Exactly.
In this particular case, you've got to gear up. And plus, I think part of it is Chicago. Chicago does have sort of an international reputation for what happened in 1968. No one politically in Chicago or Chamber of Commerce or anybody wants that to happen again. Nor does the police department.
I don't know. I think a shrewd political figure, and Rahm Emanuel is the shrewdest. I respect him more than any politician I can think of. But I think a shrewd politician would have come out and said, you know, Chicago's a place for free and open discourse, which he has said. He has protected the protesters' right to march, and the city's granted permits. Permits hadn't been denied. There was some scuffling and fighting about which permits would be granted. But it could have been turned into an economic boon for the city to say, well, all right, we're going to give Grant Park over to the protesters during the summit, and we're going to have a community festival, and we're going to let those protesters organize their own activities
It's possible we could have done something slightly different with the protesters. It's also true in the very short term, for a few days, there are economic costs. But let's not forget that we're moving into a global economy more and more every day. The future of Chicago is more and more going to be determined outside, not just of Chicago, but outside of the boundaries of the United States. This is the most high-profile military conference in the world, with 28 of the richest countries in the world coming, and for this weekend, focusing on Chicago. This will help us.
Speaking to something that the Occupy movement talks about, and that is when you talk about the richest nations in the world, do the richest nations in the world give enough to help the poor of the world? Nothing is enough.
Although most Americans think that we give a tremendous amount of our GNP away in foreign aid, it's pennies, not just on the dollar, but on the tenth of a dollar. And the reason many Americans think that is because there are a couple countries where we give billions of dollars to. We give billions of dollars every year to Israel, and because of that, we also give billions of dollars to Egypt, and we don't give billions, but over a billion to Jordan. Outside of those three
Pakistan.
Countries? Pakistan just recently. I meant for many years.
They're moving in the top five.
Well, but we're giving that money to Pakistan to help our security specifically. And, of course, there's questions whether we're getting our money's worth. But the bottom line is that other countries also don't give a tremendous amount. A few do. The Norwegians do. So a few countries do. But no one gives a lot of money to help the poor, Bruce. It's just simply not part of what countries do with their budgets.
You've got to think also, Bruce, that several years ago, a well-known economist named Jeffrey Sachs said that all the major economies of the world should give X percent of GDP to the poor of Africa and so forth, and this will go a long way towards solving the problems. And I was talking to some other well-known economists, and they just wonder, what could he possibly have been thinking, that you're going to give this money to these kleptocracies that steal money and make sure it goes into the military instead of into the hands of the people? I know that we want to try to help the world. The best way we can do that is continue to grow and have open markets and trade with the world. And if they have products we can buy, this will allow them to grow. But giving them money straight out, especially if they're run by dictators, is a disaster.
What is, Mark, what is government's, not just this government, what is government's responsibility to help poor beyond their borders?
Sure. Well, I think as what you're seeing is a generational shift in the idea that you spoke to, Professor, which is that we're more interconnected than we've ever been. There's a global community. And so what you're going to see is hopefully eventually a de-emphasis of military intervention and an increase in interrelationships based on commerce and mutual understanding, hopefully. And I think that's sort of the Occupy.
Well, wait a minute. I want to kind of cut through the.
So what should a government do? I want to try to cut through
what you just said. And I'm going to ask this question.
All right, do it.
Okay. I'm a 67-year-old taxpayer living in the city of Chicago, okay? Mm-hmm. When I see starving children on television, it bothers me. Mm-hmm. I do not have enough money, and very few people that I know have enough money to make a significant difference when I see poverty around the world, wherever it is. Let's say even in Pakistan, pick one country, or sure. anywhere in South America, or Mexico.
Sure.
What is the average person supposed to be doing to help the plight of someone around the world who they have empathy for, but they don't have the ability. What do you want me to be telling my government to do to make things better? Because they're collecting taxpayers, they're collecting taxes from Americans, mm-hmm. and they should be dealing with poor Americans first. Sure. And there's a lot of poor Americans first. What upsets me is when I know that in the city of Chicago, 10 to 12 people could get killed on any particular weekend. Mm-hmm. That's 35 minutes from where I live.
Sure.
I have to be more concerned about what's happening on the south and west sides of Chicago, some of the most impoverished nation aspects of this nation. I have to be far more worried about them than starving children in Pakistan.
Sure.
Does that make me a bad guy?
Well, you've got two layers there. So you have, what is the government's role in international
aid? All governments,
aid?
Not just all our government.
Right, all government's role. And then what's the individual's responsibility here as an American? So it gets back to an idea I advanced several months ago called commercial disobedience. I said the average American consumer does not think about the global impact of any purchase they make and the ripple effect that has on the lives of others. My shirt I'm wearing tonight is made in Bangladesh. Am I aware of the conditions in which these shirts were made, how much I paid for this shirt versus the wages that person received? So part of it is becoming an informed consumer, and unfortunately, our global economic system doesn't allow for that kind of transparency.
You're right. A consumer, but let me just I'm trying to stay on the track of my situation.
The average American's first thing would be to become an informed consumer and start making purchases that are sensitive to the needs of other nations. Does that mean paying more for a product? Sometimes it means paying more for a product. But secondly, governments that are doing well have an obligation to their neighbors. Look what's happening in Europe.
What is the obligation?
All right. Well, we're a human race, last time I checked. And I think the obligation would be if, for instance, Canada suffered from a terrible natural disaster, I think most private American citizens, as well as our government, would be expected to contribute something to help those nations.
But they contribute to international NGOs that may have a CARE, a Red Cross, you know, Salvation Army, whatever it is. They contribute out of their earnings. Mm-hmm. They make contributions mm-hmm. that can be used for good causes.
Sure.
And also, frequently, you know, when there's a tsunami in Japan or Indonesia, mm-hmm. you know what? I don't get upset when I see U.S. military people flying in there to try to, you know, stem the tide of the tsunami or to clean up or to help poor people. That doesn't bother me if that happens. I don't want the United States to be sitting here gloating. But again, when you talk about an obligation, how do you put a price tag on that?
Well, Bruce, but...
You know what? I want to continue on this. We do have to pause. 1-800-723-8289. The obligation. What obligation do governments have to help poor people? Do they have one at all? Back shortly from Chicago. From Salinas, California to Cucamonga, California, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight around the table this evening. Professor Robert Pape is here. He is professor of political science at the University of Chicago, and you also taught at Dartmouth once. Right?
I did, yes, 5 years in the 1990s.
Right.
It was wonderful.
Author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, also Bombing to Win. And Cutting the Fuse,
which is also about suicide terrorism, but about how to end suicide terrorism. So the 2005 book, Dying to Win, is about the causes of suicide terrorism. And I collected, a couple years before that, the first complete database of all suicide attacks around the world. You might have thought some government would have done that. Well, governments got interested in suicide terrorism just after 9/11. I'm the person that went back with a research team and collected all the modern instances of suicide terrorist attacks starting in the early 1980s. And then when I did that, our government, other governments, foundations got very interested in this. And the data is really quite revealing because 95%, first of all, there are many non-Muslim suicide attacks. For 23 years, from 1980 to 2003, the world leader in suicide terrorism was not a Muslim group. They were the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, a Marxist group, a secular group, a Hindu group. There are also many secular suicide terrorist groups that are Muslim groups, such as the PKK in Turkey, which is another Muslim, read anti-religious, suicide terrorist group. What over 95% of all suicide attacks have in common is not religion, but a specific strategic objective, which is to end a foreign military occupation on territory that they prize. Foreign military troops on territory the terrorists prize is the best recruiting tool for suicide terrorists, which is why when we invaded not just Afghanistan, but also Iraq, and especially Iraq with so many troops, we had an explosion of suicide terrorism that was even bigger than we dealt with in the 80s and 90s.
Are things getting better or worse right now?
They're getting much better because we're ending the occupations. And as we end the occupations, the terrorism problem is drying up.
Mike Beller also joins us. He is professor of economics at DePaul University, originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And Mark Casello also joins us. He is a radical English professor, assistant radical English professor at Calumet College of St. Joseph.
Exactly right.
And yes. You write for the Huffington Post.
That is correct.
And you talked about where you bought your shirt. You used to work for Kmart.
Walmart. Close, yes.
Used to work for Walmart.
I used to work for Walmart.
Your economics wrong when you mentioned about looking at your income versus the income of the person who made your shirt. What is important is the income of the person making the shirt relative to what they would have gotten had that company not been there making that shirt for you. And there is the evidence is absolutely overwhelming that multinational corporations that go into these poor countries to create these factories want to have the best employees who come to work and do their work and so forth. They pay them more than anybody else pays them. And you've got to keep that in mind. We can't take our standard of living here and impose it on other people and say you can't produce because you can't have the same kind of labor conditions.
And by the way, to answer your question that you started to answer, I asked you the question about real practical aspects of how you react. If I'm a person that is going to pay less money for a shirt because it is maybe it's been made in a sweatshop somewhere, okay, mm-hmm. I'm going to have more money in my pocket. Mm-hmm. Now, with that money in my pocket, I may spend it. Mm-hmm. Thus, I'm helping someone else get money.
Yes.
Or if there's a disaster that strikes somewhere, I may want to write a check to the Red Cross.
Sure.
I think it is the individual responsibility to help those in need if they have the ability, but it doesn't have to be through government. That's government's principal responsibility.
Sure. No, I think... I think there's an invisible web that we create through our economic relations that has a great impact that most of us live unconsciously and don't think of. And we think of ourselves. We think, well, I need this shirt so I can take that extra $3 and, go to the ball game. We live in sort of a self-centered society where we focus on the family unit. We focus on ourselves. And you're right, when natural disasters happen, there's an outreach. But in general, America's a place where we emphasize individualism, and it's always at attention with the community. And we've never been able to, that's a foundational principle of our country, right, is that those two things are at odds.
But the bottom line is we are a helping people.
Yes, and I don't
we,
think
we generally want to make things better for people around the world.
So, and I think this, to take it back to the Occupy stuff right now, is that to have the same standard of living that a middle class family had in 1970, you'd have to make about $92,000 today, adjusted. So, and right now, those wages are stagnant. I know people who haven't had pay increases for several years, wages have been frozen. And those things take their toll on families, on the ability for families to move out of their economic position. And another part of the Occupy movement is that this crushing student loan debt. There's a generation of students who have unthinkingly through the inflating of college tuition and the easy which student loans were granted, have sort of burdened themselves, and that's going to be a challenge for this upcoming
generation. You got a whole mishmash of things in your pot.
There's so much there.
From student loans to people that can't even feed themselves.
That's right. Welcome to Occupy.
That is a quilt. Tom in Chicago, listening to us on 89 WLS. You're on the air.
Hi guys, how are you?
Okay.
Interesting conversation. I do humanitarian operations. And I have multiple problems with regards to how a lot of this happens with our government, especially in Haiti, which sits right off our coastline. And I'm not into commercial boycotting or commercial targeting because it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Hasn't done that in the last 30 years that I know of. Mm-hmm. And as far as trying to, you know, what does the average American person do in helping or pushing their government? Well, first of all, we got to push our government to do the right thing. Haiti, for example, if it wasn't for the United States Marine Corps or the U.S. military, half that aid would be still sitting at Port-au-Prince Airport. And so we have problems not only in the United States as far as USAID getting its act together, but we've got coordinating problems with the United Nations and some of the NGOs. Now, some of those NGOs are great players. Some of them are no better than IBM or any other corporation. And many of these NGOs are just in it for the PR and the money. Let's face it. So it's a quagmire, and I think that many of the groups are still disputing how to deal with these issues. In Haiti, there's no reason why the United States, Haiti has to be at the same stage that it is as it is now, sitting right off our coastline. There's no reason for that.
Can you say, however, Tom, in some cases, that there is an issue or there is a country that is just beyond help, and that really to pour money into Haiti, I don't think too many people are surprised what's happened with a lot of the aid to Haiti. It was a horrible experience. But is there many people alive today that think or thought that was going to be an efficiently run manner in which to help those who had been devastated by the tragedies down there? It wasn't a surprise to anybody. Was anybody around this table surprised?
No.
They're the collective basket case.
Well, and I think that there's a more common experience we've had with welfare. So in the 1960s, we decided through a Good Society program to dramatically pour money into anti-poverty programs. And it took 30 years, but we scaled them back in the 1990s when both parties came to realize that it had just been far too much good money after bad. Mm-hmm. It's not to say government should not have a minimum floor below which people can fall. We certainly think government should have a safety net, but to kind of go beyond that, to actually have government try to produce or create the environment in which people would have average income or sort of more equal income, mm-hmm. this is something that we basically have tried, and we ourselves realized after 30 years of massive effort just didn't work very well.
So if we can't do it in this country with our own people, we certainly are not in a position
to pass it on to the world. Which does not mean we turn our blind eye and we ignore other people. And let me just come back and simply say, international trade is one of the great ways to improve countries. Right now, Rwanda, let me just pick a country that was a basket case 20 years ago. Rwanda had one of the worst genocides in history, and that's one of the cases where we did turn a blind eye. That was really quite an ugly blot on our country that we turned a blind eye there. But what's happened to Rwanda in the last 20 years? It's now a place attracting foreign direct investment. It's becoming one of the up and comers. And how is that happening? It's happening through trade. Economic disasters happen. You mentioned yourself, tsunami relief. Well, what does the government do? The government, by providing for the general welfare, enables private citizens to donate a tremendous amount of money and then does provide money themselves. I think that in the case of tsunami relief, for instance, this was a tremendous help. And I think that this is, in fact, something that our government supports.
Right now we're facing, in terms of this coming election, The issue, for example, of how do we spend dollars on education? One big thing that's
when
come
we
up,
come back, you're going to set it up. We're going to a break, but I want to talk about that because I have said many times, any dollar not spent on education is a luxury. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, the site of the NATO summit, and the meetings continue tomorrow, and demonstrators are in the streets, and the dignitaries are in the suites, and they are parting as we speak. Before the break, you were going to make a point about education.
Yeah,
Mark.
My point had to do with both education and allocation of scarce resources. Well, you know, governments have to decide where to put the money. And one thing in this particular election, of course, is going to be something like Head Start. Do we put this money into early childhood education? Everybody agrees that we should. There's one problem. Every single time economists have looked at what is the effect of Head Start over time, it completely disappears by the fourth grade. It does not do what everybody thinks it does. Now, to say this, I'm sure if we had another hour, there 10 phone calls would come in about it. What an evil person I am to somehow attack Head Start. But I've got to look at the data, and the data just don't support putting the money there. Me, I like, for example, community college. I think more so than four-year colleges, this is where the money needs to go, to teach people to be welders and truck drivers and bookkeepers and so forth. This is so valuable.
Next time you're around, let's do a show on that.
Absolutely.
I think that's an excellent point. Now, let us also talk, before the last break, I talked about trends in Europe, political trends in Europe. We're obviously talking about NATO and the economic implications and how important Europe is to our relationship here in the United States. And that is, there's the countries that want to grow and the countries that want to tighten their belts with austerity programs because of many of the nations in Europe have some significant, you know, economic issues.
They do, Bruce. And so yesterday afternoon, I was at a small function with the Dutch Prime Minister, and it was really quite – many of the listeners or many people ask, you know, what happens at these conferences? Well, there's the formal session. Then there's what happens on the sidebars. And many of the sidebars are as important as what happens in the – and I asked him. I said, so, Mr. Prime Minister, what have you been spending your time with outside of Dutch politics? What do you spend the most time on? And he said, well, a year ago, it was Greece. One day a week, I was talking about Greece. Now it's Germany. Everything is about Germany. And it's because the big debate in Europe on money and the future of the economies is, should there be austerity, that is cutting back of spending, or should there be growth, that is investment? Germany has been the leader of the austerity school, that is very nervous that any effort to put money into economies will end up with inflation. And what you're seeing is this is a major issue even in this weekend in Chicago because, of course, after all, military spending hinges on economic spending. So it's impossible to truly divorce these two. And this puts a sharper point on what happens at these conferences. We have real issues being decided, even if they're not front and center.
Dan in Vernon Hills, Illinois, listening to us on 89 WLS, our flagship station. Go ahead.
Hey, Bruce. Great show.
Thank you.
Occupy is really great at pointing out problems. They love to highlight disparities and income and everything like that. And they're great at saying what's wrong. And they love to hide what they would do to fix it. It's always kind of a mishmash, you know, or it's pretended like they don't know what they would do to fix it. But basically, you know, what is their philosophy to fix everything? There's only
all right. Let's let Mark address that.
Hi, Dan. Well, I don't speak for the Occupy movement, and if they were here, they'd invite you down to their General Assembly meeting that they have twice a week in Chicago. But one thing, you're right, they do point out a lot of problems, and that's where a lot of social change starts. But for instance, take for example the demonstration the other day with the National Nurses United Union. They're calling for a transaction tax on financial transactions, taking it to the Wall Street traders, is how they put it, to fund education and healthcare initiatives for low-income families. And they want that direct relationship between that tax, that money to be funneled directly into the services that have been cut and privatized.
What would be the impact of that, Mike?
Well, it's clearly people may then begin to decide whether they're going to trade or not trade based upon a tax, which will affect the decision-making. And keep in mind that not everybody who trades on Wall Street is trading for billions of dollars.
Sure.
Anytime my pension has to be traded or my 403B, this matters to me. What about my in-laws who are in their early 80s? What if they had to make a trade? You're going to charge them a tax now at their 80, at their, you know, being old, and because you have to somehow give money to people. I'm not sure that's the right way.
What's your answer to that?
Well, I'd say, I mean, if you look at Chase Bank, they lost $2 billion in the past week, and there's
10% of their assets.
Right. Well, that's $2 billion that could have funded public mental health in Chicago for 25 years.
Well, so you're going to take it from them? That's their money. You can't just go and take money from corporations.
Well, for example, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, they took $115 million away from the state of Illinois to fund for themselves, for their corporate profits, and they made $1 billion last year. They don't have any corporate ownership in the community. I think corporations should be responsible. I worked for Walmart, and one thing they did is, you know, for all the havoc and complaints about Walmart, they tried to invest in the local communities.
But I'd like to say, I think that for the movement, it's very important for the movement to actually come up with real proposals. What Mark's talking about is a real proposal. It's not to say that we should accept it. After all, we're a democracy. But what protest movements, I think, where they can be the most helpful is not just in identifying problems, but coming up with an actual proposal. And I have to say, so far, the Occupy movement hasn't been very short on proposals. And if the movement is going to have political legs, especially in a coming election cycle, this is going to be very important.
And if your only answer is you have money and I want money, I'm going to take it from you, that's not an answer. I'm sorry, that's not an answer in a free society.
No, but I think people want the opportunity for an education to raise a family, and they want wages that are commensurate with the work they do. And I think if there's a middle class that's back.
But just don't try to take the money out of my hide.
But if we don't have a middle class, we don't have a functional economy.
Fine middle class.
On that note, we will continue this discussion between now and November, which sounds like what this election is going to be all about. Listen, thanks very much for being with us tonight. Professor Robert Pape, Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. Mike Miller, Professor of Economics at DePaul University. And Mark Casello, who is a contributor for the Huffington Post. And he is also not a member of Occupy Chicago, but he's a supporter of the Occupy movement. And he writes about it in the Huffington Post. And he's going to take off his shirt and tie. And you're going to go out and put your shirt on and demonstrate the rest of the night?
That's right. Yeah, I'll be heading down, I'm sure. And,
okay. Either that or you're going to be the best dressed demonstrator in Chicago.
That's right.
This program is a Genevieve production, produced and associated with WLS Talk Radio. Thanks this evening to Dan, Patrick Johnson, and also to Dan Dorfman and Khalil Palil for their assistance in the production of the show. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.